This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Americans growing more pessimistic about the war on terror. Prison time ahead for a former Israeli prime minister. The U.S. military undergoes a big change.
As long as they qualify and meet the standards, women will now be able to contribute to our mission in ways they could not before. They'll be allowed to drive tanks, fire mortars, and lead infantry soldiers into combat.
We'll hear about the top streaming pop music hits of the year. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A new national poll reveals that despite recent setbacks, the rise of the Islamic State is convincing a large minority of Americans surveyed that terrorists are winning the war against extremism. The poll, conducted by the cable news network CNN and Opinion Research Corporation, shows 40% say the terrorists have the upper hand. The results follow a series of events, including the mass shootings in Paris and San Bernardino, California, and the perception that the government's anti-terror response is inadequate. Almost three-quarters said they are dissatisfied with the progress in the war on terror, and a majority are unhappy with the Obama administration's response, especially the policy on defeating the Islamic State, or ISIS. Tom Sanderson, director of the Transnational Threat Program at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's difficult to determine who is actually winning, and the issue will play a significant role in the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
I would certainly say that ISIS is very strong. They are on the march in many places. They are losing territory in other places. But generally speaking, I do think that ISIS is showing itself to be a durable, effective, persistent, lethal threat. And we should be doing more to counter that threat. But I don't think we need to act like we are under siege and under attack and that this is an existential threat.
Tom, what are the implications for the 2016 election?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Candidates on the right are going to use the advances by ISIS, including the attacks in the U.S., to portray Hillary Clinton as part of a weak Obama-led response that she was originally a part of. And I think that's going to be something she will have to face down, but I think something that she can challenge quite effectively. But the Republicans do have a point that the president does not seem to be out in front of this on a messaging level. And they're claiming that also on a policy level with the strategy that he's not doing well either. And the reality is they simply don't know all of what's going on behind the scenes. Nobody does except for those people who are directly engaged on the counter-ISIS effort. And a lot is going on. I do believe more should be going on. But the implications are significant for the race.
Tom Sanderson still believes the November election will turn on both foreign and domestic issues. Max Abrams, an analyst with Northeastern University in Boston, tells Victor Beatty it's quite common for observers to believe that terrorists are winning.
Almost regardless of what the outcome of the violence happens to be, observers conclude that that's exactly what the terrorists wanted to happen. So, for example, after the 2001 terrorist attack, President Bush decided for the U.S. to occupy Iraq. And many people at the time said, don't occupy Iraq because that's exactly what al-Qaeda wants. In 2004, al-Qaeda struck Madrid in the train attack, and Spain had the opposite reaction. It withdrew its forces from Iraq. And at the time, critics said, well, that's exactly what al-Qaeda wants. So whether the terrorists provoke a country or whether they force the country into becoming more conciliatory, observers will very often conclude that that's exactly what the terrorists want. And so for that reason, people all the time tend to overestimate the skill and the sophistication and intelligence of terrorists. The fact that so many Americans think that the terrorists are winning isn't actually an indication that the terrorists are winning.
Well, do you see the numbers changing in the new year if, in fact, this decline becomes persistent?
Yes, I do. I think that there's probably a lag between what's going on in the world of Islamic State and how it's perceived by Americans. And if there are continued successes against Islamic State, I think Americans will have to change their minds. Although all of that is contingent on the U.S. homeland remaining safe.
Among the survey's conclusions is that the White House understands that beyond a coherent and winning military strategy, it also needs a domestic plan to win the political debate over the threat of terrorism. A former Israeli prime minister is heading to prison after a long corruption scandal. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's Supreme Court Tuesday partially overturned a bribery conviction against former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. His sentence was reduced from 6 years to 18 months in prison. Olmert expressed relief, saying a great burden has been lifted from his heart. The ex-prime minister, who is 70, was convicted 2 years ago by a lower court of accepting tens of thousands of dollars in bribes to promote a controversial real estate project in Jerusalem. This allegedly occurred when he served as the mayor of Jerusalem prior to becoming prime minister in 2006. Olmert denies it. He says, I was never offered and I never took a bribe. Nevertheless, while the Supreme Court overturned some of the bribery charges, it upheld others. Therefore, Olmert will become the first former Israeli leader to spend time behind bars. State prosecutor Liat Ben-Ari says justice was served. She says the case represents a watershed in the war against corruption in Israel. The justice system, Ben-Ari says, has sent a strong message that no one is above the law. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Mr. Olmert led the centrist Kadima Party when he was prime minister and worked on pushing forward peace talks with the Palestinians before leaving office in 2009. It appears that 2015 was the year of the U.S. military woman. After years of studies and trials, all military positions, including combat posts, are opening up to females. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb takes us to this new world for women in the military.
A historic decision these women had been waiting for. From Secretary of Defense Ash Carter.
As long as they qualify and meet the standards, women will now be able to contribute to our mission in ways they could not before. They'll be allowed to drive tanks, fire mortars, and lead infantry soldiers into combat. They'll be able to serve as Army Rangers and Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Marine Corps infantry, Air Force parajumpers, and everything else that was previously open only to men.
Two soldiers, Kristen Greist and Shay Haver, became the first women to pass the Army's Elite Ranger course back in August. Here's Captain Greist.
You can't really have an off day. You can't be tired. You need to go the extra mile.
Their achievement helped clear the way for the Army's recommendation to allow women in all posts.
I think probably soon we're going to say, God dang it, why didn't we do this 10 years ago?
General Ben Hodges, the commander of U.S. Army Europe, says he's excited about the future force and doesn't worry about the naysayers.
It's going to make us smarter, more effective, and that rather than criticizing, they should be out encouraging great young men and women to want to step forward and serve their country.
One branch, however, wasn't quite ready to ask women to serve in its infantry. The Marine Corps provided testing which showed male-only Marine units were faster and more lethal. When it came to critical thinking, however, the joint male-female units outperformed the male-only groups. Catherine Kidder is with the Center for a New American Security.
So the question that it sets up there is, what kind of military do we want? What kind of Marine Corps do we want? Is it one that's purely physical, or is it one where critical thinking plays a part in an otherwise very physical, demanding job?
In the end, experts say the decision was not just about fairness, but talent.
And likewise, just because you're a man doesn't necessarily mean you were qualified for the position to begin with.
And based on the new military rules, ability, not the gender of these troops, will determine their fate. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Still to come, learning leadership from animals. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Could playing Tetris, a classic video puzzle game, help drug addicts and compulsive eaters overcome or reduce their addictions or obsessions with food? Psychologists in the UK and Australia worked with 31 college students as test subjects. The students were randomly sent text message prompts 7 times throughout the day over a week-long period, asking them to report any cravings they were feeling. About half of the volunteers who reported cravings were also told to play Tetris on an iPod for 3 minutes. Following gameplay, the subjects again reported on the intensity of their cravings. The researchers found that playing Tetris can weaken cravings for drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, coffee, and food by as much as 20%. Lowered cravings were also observed in the volunteers for sex and sleeping. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. One of the top stories of 2015 on social media was the plight of the more than 1 million refugees and migrants who entered Europe during the year. Many had fled from conflicts and poverty in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and from poor living conditions in regional refugee camps. This week's hashtag VOA TV program looked at the refugee issue and the year's other top social media stories, and its host Michael Lippin joins me now in the studio. Michael, who did you have in this week's panel?
Hi, Ray. Well, for our final show of 2015, I had a lively discussion on the big stories of the year with VOA's social media editor, Andrew Palchevsky, and with an audience editor for The Washington Post, Jessica Stahl. Now, as you were saying, Europe's massive refugee influx was one of a dozen or so topics that we looked at in the show, and how that influx generated lots of sympathy and support for the refugees with the hashtag #RefugeesWelcome. Now, I asked Stahl how the Washington Post handled its coverage of the Refugees Welcome campaign.
We'd been covering it all year, but really it was one of those stories that didn't break out until there was that one moment where there was the photo of the Syrian boy, the young toddler who had washed up on the shores of Turkey, I think it was. And that was the moment where suddenly you saw the world pay attention and realize the scale of this tragedy that was happening. I think people sort of saw it as something that was happening somewhere else, didn't really understand the sheer magnitude of what was going on.
But it and put that a human photo, face on it, didn't it?
Absolutely. From that moment, it really focused people's attention and it really got people. You know, you saw even here in the U.S., people putting on social media their offers to house Syrian refugees and willingness to take people in, and that was happening all over Europe.
And one country where there was a lot of support for the refugees in this year was Germany. And Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, changed German policy, actually, during the summer to allow more refugees to come in. So what was the kind of Twitter reaction like in Germany to the refugees?
Well, you saw this hashtag refugees welcome and a lot of the people supporting the refugees using that to voice that. And then with social media, it wasn't just people using it as a support tool, it was actually the refugees themselves using it. One of the most interesting stories I found from this year was refugees using things like WhatsApp and Facebook to not only connect with families back home to try to bring them forward to Europe, connecting with people who had already gone through and were in Europe to say, okay, this is the best path to get through, this is how you get through the borders, these are the tips and tricks to make it. So I think that's been a huge way that social media has been powerful this year in the refugee story.
Do you remember people kind of freaked out at the time? They said, how are these refugees, how do they have cell phones? Like,
right. They're
these poor people, they're going through this horrible situation. If they have cell phones, it can't be that bad. And what people didn't realize was that if they were going to leave everything else behind, they were going to take their cell phone because that was what they needed to hear what other people's experiences had been, to find out things like Hungary is closing the borders or Hungary is, you know, you're going to have to walk to Germany from the border here.
Right. And actually organizations that were trying to support and help the refugees as they were arriving to Europe were using social media to get information out to these people to connect with them. So I think they all benefited from using social media as a communications tool.
And it humanized them too, because as you were saying, these people brought their cell phones, and as you saw their posts on social media, you were realizing these are students, these are professionals, engineers, doctors. These aren't, you know, just poor people. These are well-educated people that are really searching for a better life and leaving everything behind to get there.
One of my favorite stories we did this year was we just asked a whole bunch of Syrian refugees, what did you do before you left Syria? And it really was. It was students, doctors, dentists. It was all these professional people. And that really put the message home that, like, this could be anyone. These are real people in horrible situations.
That was Jessica Stahl of The Washington Post, and you also heard there VOA's social media editor, Andrew Palchevsky. Now, some of the other topics that we covered in the show were the social media response to the terrorist attacks in Paris and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement here in the U.S. If you'd like to hear more of that, you can find the show on our Facebook page, which is called #VOA. Ray?
Thanks, Michael. And staying with social media, G. Abby Lee is here to tell us about Twitter picking up a most influential user this year, President Barack Obama. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray. That's right. The leader of the free world joined one of the most popular social media platforms in May, and this is his first tweet. Hello, Twitter. It's Barack. Really, 6 years in, they're finally giving me my own account. That tweet has been shared almost 200,000 times and received more than 415 likes. His handle is at POTUS.
Gee, what are some of the other tweets that are resonating with people since that time?
Ray, about a month after joining Twitter sphere, Mr. Obama sent out this tweet. Now, this received more likes than his first tweet. Today is a big step in our march toward equality. Gay and lesbian couples now have the right to marry just like anyone else. #LoveWins. That's in reference to legalization of same-sex marriage. Other popular tweets include one addressed to a Muslim high schooler, Ahmed Mohammed. Mohammed got arrested at his own high school when his teacher mistakenly thought his homemade clock for a bomb. This is what President Obama wrote. Cool clock, Ahmed. Want to bring it to the White House? We should inspire more kids like you to like science. It's what makes America great.
So is President Obama actually using Twitter as a means to express the administration policies?
I think so. Now, that brings us to another tweet on one of his passions, gun control. He sent out this tweet in late June following the Charleston shooting. Here are the stats. Per population, we kill each other with guns at a rate 297 times more than Japan, 49 times more than France, 33 times more than Israel. Let's check out one of his latest tweets, and this one is on the issue of immigrants. Slamming the door in the face of refugees would betray our deepest values. That's not who we are, and it's not what we're going to do. Now, before I go, I want to say that there are around 310 million monthly active users on Twitter, and I'm one of them at G. Abby Lee. Ray?
Thanks, G. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. You no doubt have often heard the phrase, it's a jungle out there. Well, much of the time you can say it's not only out there. We as humans can have a much harder time creating order and leadership than our cousins in the animal kingdom. A team of scientists studying leadership in several societies of mammals over the past 2 years found out humans can learn a few lessons from the animals. Here's VOA's Faith Lapidus.
To find out what makes a good leader in humans and other animals, researchers first had to define it.
A leader is an individual that by doing an action promotes others to follow a certain set of rules. So they have an influence on other individuals within a society.
Jennifer Smith, biologist at Mills College in California, participated in the study. She says the research looked at elephant herds, packs of hyenas, and monkey troops, and small-scale human societies.
The reason that we were interested in that is we wanted to understand the origins of cooperation, to look back in time. Mm-hmm. So we can look at how leadership roles may have evolved.
To be able to compare leaders across multiple species, researchers reviewed evidence of leadership in four areas: movement, food acquisition, within-group conflict mediation, and between-group interactions or fights.
Within our animal societies, there were quite a few differences across species, and some of the species were more equitable as well. So lions, for example, they tend to breed cooperatively. Individuals will help each other in rearing offspring. And when it comes to feeding, they also are more equitable in sharing. Even though they have particular leadership roles during hunting, the food is often shared in a broader way. We see similarities to that in human societies.
But they see differences in the way human and some non-human leaders exercise power within the group.
If you look at a chimpanzee or look at a hyena and the way that they dictate power, a leader might be socially dominant and control all of the resources, whereas in human societies, oftentimes it's more equitable and there's more sharing of the benefits that a leader might actually help to obtain.
Scientists have also found experience to be one of the main characteristics of leadership, with some exceptions.
So it's not how charismatic you are or who your mom was necessarily. Things like that are less important than the amount of experience individuals have on the ground. In elephants, for example, we noticed that older matriarchs in the society, so females that have been in these groups for many years, that are very long-lived and have this knowledge, are the ones that are calling the shots. And there were a couple of cases that were particularly interesting where rank was inherited. And we saw this in spotted hyenas, where the individuals will basically learn their rank of their mom, and they inherit it right below their mom. In those societies, the distribution of resources seems to be less equitable.
After looking closely at these species, Smith says, it became clear that we could learn something from other mammals. A leader, it said, knows the way, goes the way, and shows the way. The validity of that idea, Smith and her fellow researchers say, is on display in many parts of the animal world. Experience matters, and successful, experienced leaders can pave the way for a successful society. It's not new information, perhaps, but it can help reinforce the importance of experience in a world that seems to be constantly looking for the next new thing. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
The way we listen to music has shifted dramatically in the digital era as streaming emerges as the prime method of hearing the newest songs. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joined International Audition's Jim Stevenson to chart the biggest artist in terms of streaming for 2015, along with a couple of notable exceptions.
You used to call me on my...
Streaming was the hot music delivery system of 2016. It's been growing by leaps and bounds for the last few years. It's also the most controversial because people have been saying that artists need to be paid more. The royalties seem a little minuscule for the huge amount of streams that are going on. And of course, Taylor Swift last year withdrew all of her songs from streaming in protest of that. Nevertheless, the Spotify team earlier in December put out its list of the most streamed artists and songs for the year. And the most streamed artist of 2015 turned out to be Drake.
Ever since I left the city, you got a reputation for yourself now.
He had over 1.8 billion streams and 46 million listeners. And so he replaces Ed Sheeran as the number one streaming artist of the year. The most streamed female of 2015 was Rihanna, with 1 billion streams and 57 million listeners. But that should come with an asterisk, because the two biggest selling female acts, Adele and Taylor Swift, are not streaming their songs.
Yeah, and along with Taylor Swift, Adele made that decision not to stream.
That's right. Taylor Swift, of course, wants to see better compensation for artists. Adele says she likes her music to be an event. She wants it to have more meaning than just be a digital stream.
So who else do we have on the list, Ray?
The most streamed song of 2015 was Lean On by Major Lazer with Mo and DJ Snake. Spotify users listened to it 540 million times over the year. And it's also the most streamed song of all time on Spotify. I'm sure that record will fall in 2016. Streaming is only going up. And something that also may help the cause of streaming happened on Christmas Eve. The Beatles finally made their back catalog available on 9 different streaming platforms.
That's huge.
I mean, the Beatles have always been a little bit slow to adapt online music delivery systems. They weren't even available for downloading until 2015. And the rationale before this was that their music publishers didn't want to cut into sales of reissue and compilation CDs. Mm-hmm. But by now, they figure that the pool is big enough so that there's room for everything.
And they've been around for so long, their music is just out there, here, there, and everywhere.
Very good, very good. A couple other facts and figures for you. The most streamed album of 2015 was The Weeknd, Beauty Behind the Madness. And the most streamed artist of all time is still Ed Sheeran. He has more than 3 billion streams to date and over 59 million listeners this year.
Always counting down the hits for us, Ray McDonald. He counts down the top 20 every week right here on VOA. You can also follow him on Twitter.
Ray on the hits.
And Ray is number one in our books. Ray, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much, Jim.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts right on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain. As our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60 to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa, $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria, and $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.